Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Greece is officially in default. U.S. adds 200,000 to the employment rolls, and Starbucks roast Green Mountain. We have mutual fund manager Mark Hanna here with us today from the Paladin Long Short Mutual Fund. All this and much more on episode number 254 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey, how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and it is episode number 254. We are at March 12th, the week starting March 12th of 2012. And now all of a sudden things are changing. The game has changed. We officially find that all the rhetoric, all the discussion, all the blowhardness of the Eurozone leaders that said that under no circumstances would Greek default happen has happened. And in fact, we saw that the CDS, or as they're better known, as the credit default swaps, have triggered. There was a vote on Friday afternoon that said that the credit default swaps were going to trigger because of a variety of mechanisms, one of them being that the, I guess we call it the voluntary, involuntary, required, unrequired, forcible, unforcible tender of notes and the payout of about 70% less than was originally bought for on the Greek notes was implemented. And there was a variety of other things that happened, and there was some special mechanism inside of the bonds that were called because some of the people didn't want to actually give up their money. who would figure that, right? They didn't want to give up on that, and what happened was that the triggering happened, creating about a $30 billion payment. And already we're seeing that an Austrian bank has requested some cash infusion because they're going to be light on their numbers when it comes to their tier one ratios. So what's happening is now we're going to see the effects of this spreading out over the next week. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad, because already we've known that the European leaders have planned for this. They've come to the conclusion that they have to do this, and it's an invariable situation that is going to occur. And what they did was simply make sure the backstops were there between the LTRO and all the other things. So we'll see what happens. I do tell you, if I can predict anything, we're going to see this Me Too thing happening very shortly, where we're going to see Portugal probably next up on the plate saying, hey, you know what? Wow, Greece, look what they did. They were able to basically discharge 70% of their debt. Look at that. And they all they had to do is put in all these austerity measures that they really don't have to keep, and they get all this great benefit to reduce down their overall expenses and their payments to bondholders, and maybe we'll try that. So keep on the lookout for that. I hope we don't see Spain actually next up, but it looks like it's probably going to be Portugal, Italy, somewhere there. But Portugal is really the key place right now that we're seeing that go on. The unemployment rate in the EU zone is obviously very much tilted, and between Portugal and Spain and Greece, I mean, you're talking about, you know, upwards of 20% unemployment in many of those areas. And when you look at the under 25-year-olds, you're talking about 50% unemployment rate. Kind of ripe for the riots that are going on and the potential, I mean, if it was anywhere else, an overthrow of the leadership, but that's not going to happen there, at least under the ways that we saw it in the Middle East. It may be in a vote, but right now there's a lot of discontent when it comes to the under 25-year-old population out of work. The employment numbers, on the other hand, in the U.S. are looking much better, aren't they? We saw another month of gains over 200,000. Actually, last month was ratcheted higher on the revision, which was nice to see. But I think the most important thing that we need to recognize from this week, or this month, or last week, but this month's number, was that the labor participation rate actually moved a little bit higher. Now, if you recall, we've been talking about that for some time, that the unemployment rate was about 8.3% last month, 8.3% this month. But in the last several months, we saw the labor participation rate, the amount of people in the labor pool, shrinking. Now, when that happens, there's less people to count. And when you look at the unemployment rate, obviously it throws it out of kilter because the people that aren't working, that are fed up, they're tired, they're disgusted, they're just going to say, I'm not going to be looking for a job anymore, I'm done. When they leave, it changes the calculation, and those people who were counted as unemployed before are no longer in the calculation. Therefore, the unemployment rate naturally moves lower. So it's a bit of a statistical anomaly when you see the labor participation rate the lowest in 40 or 50 years and the unemployment rate going down. If you see the actual numbers, if you look at like shadow stats or you look at actually the calculation based on a consistent level of the labor participation rate, you're probably about 2 points higher, probably closer to still a 10% unemployment rate. But nonetheless, it was a little bit higher. Ever so slightly, the labor participation rate did increase, and that was good to see. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens moving forward. But right now, the numbers in the U.S. look much better. In fact, we're seeing a lot more earning surprises to the upside and of through the period. Although, you know, revenues were not good. But more importantly, I think, the economic surprises were good. Now, is this a bullish sign? It's just facts. You know, we have to look at the trends of the market. As a matter of fact, we knocked our, the calculation did. The market trend indicator, which we use for finding out, you know, kind of unemotionally and objectively, what is the actual underpinnings of this market? Is it a strong uptrend, an uptrend, a downtrend, a strong downtrend, or a correction, if you will? Where is it? Well, right now, it was at a strong uptrend for a while there, since December or so, maybe in January. It knocked down one notch when it passed through a couple of zones last week on that move downward. So right now, we're in a still in an uptrend, but we're in a uptrend with a warning sign in front of it that things are starting to look a little different than they were. Now, I've been watching last week. One of the things that happened was that Starbucks announced their new Verissimo, I think it's called, Verissimo machine. It's a single cup brewer. They say primarily for espresso. We'll see where they go with it. But it's a single cup brewer, and who is that going to hurt? Green Mountain Coffee. Green Mountain Coffee was down about 20%, 22% on the news in after hours. Now, let me tell you what happened. This was interesting. During the day on Thursday, there was a lot of chatter about this announcement. No one really knew what it was that was coming after the close on Thursday. Starbucks was going to announce something. Who knows? They were going to announce a change, maybe an update, an expansion. We didn't know. But a lot of chatter came in saying that this is probably going to be a net neutral for Green Mountain. Probably had no effect on them. If anything, it could be a positive. In the morning, there was a sell-off about 6% of Green Mountain on Thursday morning. Came back mostly all the way throughout the day. Then when the news hit, like I said, it just went from about 62 to about, at the low point, I think 48, 49. Now, the nice thing was the day before, we put out a breaking down alert for our Trigger Point Research alert subscribers. Now, we had that open for some trials, and we had that open for people on the who were watching it on Twitter. And hopefully you grabbed that, but that was good for about a 20% gain. Now, it helped, obviously, that two things were present. Number one, there was a situation where there was a breaking down condition that was there. So when you look at the information and the algorithms that we put together, basically there was a situation that was present. But obviously the news, you know, you can't leave off the news. The news obviously helped to really take that down pretty significantly. Now you have to ask yourself, you know, which came first? Was there something behind the scenes, a buzz that people knew about that was kind of starting to take the wind out of the sails of Green Mountain before the announcement? We already see this, an investigation going on into the incredible amount of puts that were initiated just before the announcement. But that was good news. The alerts worked nicely for that. In fact, you know, we have that 14-day trial. The alert is now live. You go to Trigger Point Research. I encourage you to check this out because if nothing else, you should see what it's doing, how it's doing it. And there's a whole explanation on the site on how you can actually get this 14-day. This will not be forever, by the way. The 14-day trial is probably to the end of this month. So if you want to grab that, I suggest you do that soon. But basically, what this has is a user's guide you can check out there, and it tells you about the alerts. And these are things that come via email, via text message, and they're on the website immediately to you with an explanation, a discussion, and an exact plan on the triggering point of when you're going to get in and potentially when you're going to get out for a profit point or, on the other hand, for a stop. Now, last week we mentioned that, we did Green Mountain Coffee. You picked that up at 20%. The week before that, we did Molly Corp. You made about 17% on that on Friday. Spectrum Pharmaceuticals is about flat. We also did Carbo Ceramics, about 9%. There's probably about six or seven more on there, and most of them, if not all of them, are positive, both long and short. So you could take a look at those, because if you go to the website, Trigger Point Research, and you click on the recent alerts on the top, the latest alerts, just right on the top there, it will come up with a chronological order of all the alerts that have been issued. Some of those you're not going to be able to see because they're just for subscribers, but it'll tell you how to get the quick 14-day trial and all that. And then, so you need to check that out. I'm going to tell you about that a few times in the next few podcasts, but I really encourage you, if you haven't done it yet, Trigger Point Research. We'll put links on this show notes for the show. Coming up to next week, we have not much left in the earnings season. It's kind of coming to an end, but clean energy fuels is coming up, and this is CLNE. We've been talking about that for a while. We talked about with Frank a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about the whole idea of natural gas. What a disaster. Natural gas at just off of a historic low. You know, you have just an amazing amount of natural gas, and nobody's using it, it seems. Even though we know that they're using it in the liquefied form in Japan, they're going to be importing that, and the numbers are up significantly for around the world, just not in the U.S. You want to blame it on the seasonality and of the weather? You want to blame it on the fact that we have just a horrible energy plan here? Well, probably. You want to blame it on anything that we have so much of it? Well, okay. But if we have so much of it, without getting into too much detail about this, doesn't it seem logical that we should be using it? If it's that cheap comparatively, what the heck are we doing not developing it? Not developing it from the standpoint of usability. Well, that's what Clean Energy does, Westport Innovations does, and a few other companies that we've mentioned before on here that we like. And those things have been, look at the charts on that. CLNE, WPRT, Westport Innovations, wow. Very, very impressive. Even though natural gas prices are coming down, which maybe talks about just the basic concern about the amount of it, the fact is that these stocks are doing very well, because the reality is that, I guess what's happening is the realization that someday this is going to be used, and why not get on this now? So these things that we like, I like these positions, and they've had some really just incredible upside the last few weeks. All right, let's see what else we have to talk about here before we get to our esteemed guest today. Mixed signals from the market I wrote down here that I want to talk to you about. It looks like there's some, you know, some other tiredness coming in. This rally is getting a little bit old. I will tell you, though, it doesn't really matter. It is what it is. And as we see the continuation of injections of stimulus by the various players out there, whether it's, you know, the European region, U.S., and now Bernanke even came up with some crapola about doing sterilizing the bond issues and bond buying and blah de blah de blah. I mean, it just goes on and on and on with the amount of reserves that are being dropped or something's being raised. And it's just this constant tinkering that's going on around the world right now. But one of the things that you have to look at is next week we have Fed speak. And I got to tell you, with the recent surprises on the upward side of economics, it would be hard pressed for me to figure out how the Fed wants to continue without looking kind of silly. How are they going to continue just flushing money into the system? Already Germany, by the way, had said over the weekend that they wanted to have the ECB slow down on the push of the money into the system because it's getting too much. Now that things have calmed down a little bit, now that the banks are a little bit more better balanced, or backed, at least I should say, not balanced, but backed, they don't want this money flushing into the system and creating extraordinary amounts of inflation. So we'll see. They really want this kind of a reversal of some of this, the excess. They want the mopping up of the excess stimulus that's in the system, the excess liquidity that's in the system, because they believe it's going to cause not only a moral hazard, but cause potential for runaway inflation and excess prices in terms of commodities. So you got to watch for that. That's something you want to kind of keep in your mind. And when you see the reversal of some of these trends of excess liquidity being added to the market, be careful, because when that happens, all of a sudden you'll see the reversal of the markets. That's how things are standing today. That's how things are playing today. is all based on the amount of liquidity in the markets. So just remember that. Keep that in the back of your head. I'll mention really quickly, I mentioned Trigger Point Research. You got to go check that out. I'll mention that at the end of the show, too, just to make sure you have it in your head. I'll also mention to you that GoToMeeting is a sponsor of this particular episode and many of our episodes, of course. And one of the things that's really nice is the new product they have, the faces, this kind of one-on-one ability to communicate with other parties as you're actually having a meeting with them. It's called GoToMeeting with HD faces, I guess high def faces. And basically, this is a product by Citrix, a really a good name that you can trust. It just takes a simple webcam, usually have on either your laptop, maybe comes with your computer. You click to collaborate in a group, and you can have a whole entire group. Just think about your whole family getting together that way. Yeah, you could do this with other things, but wouldn't it be nice to share some pictures also? Wouldn't it be nice to maybe, if you're planning a family trip, to do it all together and have everybody not only collaborating to look at the screens, to share screens, but also to see the emotions and the faces? Wouldn't that be great? You can check this out by going to gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. Be sure to use the promo code PODCAST at gotomeeting.com for 30 days of free, absolutely free, service entirely for the GoToMeeting with HD Faces program. Well, it's not really a program. It's more of an online thing. That's how easy it is. It's not really a program if you install. It's just you just get in there, you click it, gotomeeting.com, promo code PODCAST. Now, you've heard him before, and he had a kind of a different persona. Now, maybe not a persona, but he had a different hat he was wearing before, because then he was just a plain old kind of blogger. Now he's a magnificent, oh my gosh, mutual fund manager. Mark Hanna, who is, if you remember him from Fund My Mutual Fund, and now he has what's called the Market Montage and the Paladin Long Short Fund, symbol PALFX. So, man, I'm talking to a full-fledged mutual fund manager, huh?
I'm part of the cabal now with you.
You're the elite. Wow. So, you know, first let me just ask you something. Seriously, is there any daily difference? Is there anything that you go through that's like, besides compliance and all that stuff that may be there, but anything that's different now that you're doing it this way?
You pick up on a great point. Compliance, there's a lot of more, you know, paperwork. You know, any small business that you're a startup, obviously is going to be a lot of work from that end. But this, as they like to say, from out, you know, when you're outside, this is the most highly regulated industry there is, with the SEC and FINRA, et cetera. So doing anything mutual fund-wise, you just really have to jump through about 35 different hoops to, you know, if I was selling shoes, if I was selling, you know, books or whatever, I could write thank you letters to my customers. And even something as simple as that, if I ever wanted to do it, I'd have to go through a compliance. I have to pay for them to review everything. It's a whole different world than you know, when you're just kind of doing it as a retail investor from that standpoint. But, I mean, in terms of investing and strategy and that sort of thing, that's not that much different. Reporting it and that sort of thing is obviously very different, and all the backroom stuff you need to do to be a, you know, full-fledged mutual fund.
So the thing is that a lot of mutual funds, I guess until recently, a lot of mutual funds couldn't do the short side of things, or it was very difficult, or you couldn't find them actually.
It's still difficult. It's right. You know, even for myself, finding brokerage, like if you're a $500 million mutual fund or a $2 billion mutual fund, you have different issues than a $10 million or $20 million. A lot of it on the brokerage side. If you're a hedge fund, it's not an issue. There's a very specific type, I won't get into the nuts and bolts of, but there's a specific type of brokerage agreement you need, because it's not a common thing in the mutual fund world. So out of 8,000 or 9,000 mutual funds, there might be 150, 200 that even have the potential to do any shorting. So that's not a big niche business for anybody out there in the institutional world to do for mutual funds. So it's kind of difficult even to find, because you have to go to JP Morgan, you have to go to Goldman Sachs, you have to go to Jefferies, find somebody that will locate the shorts, do the shorts. And you, at this size of a fund, you don't have a direct relationship with those people. So you use what are called intermediate brokers. But they're just a very, very small niche of people who would be interested at the volume you can bring, because
Just
like, you know, HFTs. Why is algorithmic trading so popular? It's volume, 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 volume. So if you're not a huge fund, you can't bring that volume. It's just very difficult to find.
And it's called, out there, it's called pay for flow, and that's where the money comes from, is the, you know, those little bitty little pennies here and there, pennies there that come from all the different trading. Let's go, kind of talk about the idea of current, I guess, market conditions. I don't mean the current, is it going up, is it going down right now, but right. The conditions that we are in, and I've talked about this several times. It's like January 1st came, or actually midnight, December 31st came, and the clock
amazing.
Struck, and hello, I want to buy stocks. Like, everybody was like, you know what it was? I got it. I just figured it out. Seriously, I'm not kidding. There was something in that Dick Clark special. Seriously, there was like a subliminal message.
It's fund inflows on January 1st, don't you know? It's clear. No, it's amazing because I launched mid-December, and the market, when I actually launched, the actual bottom, let's say, of the second run, well, the beginning of the run was October, early October, but there was a sell-off. Thanksgiving week was the worst Thanksgiving in whatever how many years. And then we had like a lot of ups and downs kind of churning up to December 19th. But even from December 19th through December 31st, all the action was utilities, healthcare stocks that had a dividend, all these boring kind of...
All the staples?
Yeah, all those big consumer staples that had a dividend. And that was, for about the last 10 days of 2010, or 2011, sorry, what year am I in? And then, like you said, January 1st, we gapped up. I think it was like a 1.5% gap. And it was everything that succeeded in the last 2 months or 3 months of 2011, if you look at it, utilities up to about a week or two weeks ago, did nothing. Like the first two, there's been this rally, but all those names that did great at the end of 2011 were abandoned. And then on January 1st, as if a switch had turned, all cyclical. Get me into the financials. Anything that was beat up, financials,
yeah, exactly.
Cyclicals, exactly. Caterpillars. Get me into all those type of things. And it was an amazing turn because it's not like that type of turn usually would happen over, there's 3 or 4 weeks of economic data that's changing and you're morphing. You see the sector rotation. There was no sector rotation over weeks. It was a sector rotation over one night. And since then, there's no looking back. It's been amazing.
And what does that tell you, though? I mean, is this a, and by the way, that same overnight sector rotation, right? You and I have talked about this before. Has been happening in a different way, much more of a much more detailed manner, where you see a particular name or a particular sector, industry, whatever it is. But when it comes to the names of stock, where you'll see a stock get just crushed, and then 2 days later it's back. I mean, I could tell you that. Did you look at? Did you follow at all, Liz, the Elizabeth Arden, the stock, and how it was just obliterated when it came out with earnings? And it was up like 10% the next day, 12%. Or for example,
I'm familiar with the name. I didn't look at that one specifically, but yeah. I've seen very similar type of action.
Yeah, we own Acorn. It was down 10% on its news, and then it was up 7% the next day. I'm like, well,
that one I know. Yeah, I know that one pretty well as well. It's been a strange earnings season because you know the Wall Street. Anybody who's been listening to your podcast knows by now. The whole Wall Street cabal with the corporations is set a number that the corporation can beat. Everybody can clap. CNBC can say beat by, 3 cents, beat expectations. A lot of the beats in the last quarter, like I'll use Altera, for example. I happen to highlight that one on my website. They had been lower, like November, December, we thought we were going into recession. A lot of, that was the kind of, Europe is, a big cluster, And, this is before the ECB came in with their LTRO announcement, and everybody was lowering expectations dramatically November and December. So Altera, year over year, they beat their expectation. The stock shot up. This is, it's a semiconductor-related company. And it didn't beat what it had said in November, but it had beat what the analysts had lowered through November and December. And again, stock shot up. And that sort of thing. But what you're talking about is the exact opposite. There's been misses this quarter.
Oh, yeah.
All over the place. Mm-hmm. And usually when a stock misses an earnings report, most people are going to stay away from that. It needs to build a new base. It needs, usually months, 2 or 3 months of base building. And then one or two good quarters, again, and then money tends to go into that stock. This quarter, stock goes down. Next day, it's back up to where it was. Or 2 days later, it's back up where it was. It's very strange, peculiar behavior.
Well, that happened with Cena. That happened with Cena, for example.
Happened with many stocks,
yep.
Technology stocks,
yep.
across the board.
Right.
And I'm not sure why that is.
Well, how about we throw in the fact that maybe there is an underground knowledge. I don't mean this in a conspiratorial manner, but there's an underground knowledge or at least belief that there's a backstop and that it doesn't matter. And that if something's – and really the way to – The way to make up for many of these mutual fund managers who lagged the market, who were supposed to be benchmarked to the market last year, what they do, the only way they can make up for it is if they buy when things are down, because they can't lose. Because if it's down and they buy it, it goes up, they make the money. If it's down and they buy it, they're just going to be along with for the ride.
Yeah, it's kind of if you're down and everybody else is down, you're okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the same way the analyst community actually is. It's the same way. If you miss, if your expectations are too high, but everybody's expectations are too high, that's okay. You don't want to be an outlier in that business.
Yeah.
Or in any business, because you're not rewarded for it. Because if everybody's wrong, it's okay. If everybody missed, 2007 through 2009, the whole crisis, well, that's okay. Everybody lost 35%. Not an issue. But if you were an outlier in any case, you have to really be right. Because if you're an outlier and you're wrong, you stand out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened to Paulson last year as an example. Or look what happened to our friend at Fairholm. Now, they had a decent recovery there. That's the other thing. These financials, there has been, except for the fact that there's been a backstop in Europe, there really has been no benefit to the yield curve and the spread of on the yield curve for them. As a matter of fact,
the yield curve is going in the opposite direction
right,
for them, isn't it?
It's terrible.
Actually, with the Fed lowering rates or holding them now to 2014, conditional on any changes, that's actually a punishment to them. But again, I think the LPRO is—it's not a QE, it's not a quantitative easing in the direct form, but basically, it's almost like a workaround. And more than anything, a lot of these, just like you said, there's a backup. These are psychological moves as much as monetary moves. If you have a belief that, you know, the only entities on Earth that literally have unlimited capacity to create money will do so. Because what really changed in late December was you lost Trichet, a Frenchman, and you brought in Draghi, an Italian. And the idea was, have you noticed, I don't know if you follow this, Andrew, there's been a lot of Germans leaving.
Yeah, no kidding.
Axel Weber actually was supposed to be the next, he was in line, and he was going to be the next ECB president, but he was a German, and German are hard money. So whatever happened, we don't know what happened, but he stepped aside, he left, and, you know, this is about a year ago, and, Draghi, I guess, was the next person in. But when the idea when he came in was, is he going to follow more of the Trichet style, or is he, because, you know, obviously at the time, Italy and Spain were the next two big issues as well, following Portugal and Greece, and those are obviously much bigger issues. And the idea was, when he first came in, is he going to go in and be like a typical, quote-unquote, Italian banker and just, you know, be easy and that sort of thing, or is he going to at least adhere to the German policy that is around the ECB that they kind of stuck to more than any other central bank of hard money? And that was a big question that came in. And I think what changed in December, more than just even the actual injections, is you saw with that move with LTRO, and it's easy to say that in retrospect, because at the time I was blogging about it, I'm like, you know, what exactly does this mean? And I wasn't as
I still wonder what it means.
Well, you still wonder, but I think the biggest important, the most important thing is they are now willing to act like the Bank of Japan, like
right,
the Bank of England and the Fed. Before, they were the ones standouts. So what does that say to me as a speculator today? And something I still am trying to, you know, put my hands around. If things worsen in the future, because we always know in the U.S., if things worse, you know, if the stock market was down 2% last week or earlier this week, we saw a leak Wednesday morning that the Fed was considering a sterilized quantitative easing. So that was with a 2% drop. So what we see now with ECB is they are willing to act if things get worse. Now, they're not going to say that because they're still trying to be, we're the ECB. But we saw that now. Up to December, we didn't ever see that from them. We were like, well, they're going to be kind of the parents in the room. They're going to be, you know, they want the governments to work on it. They're not just going to come in and backstop everything. So I think as we're going through this now, period 2 or 3 months later, I think that was the change. And as you're saying, people are acting as if there's a backstop under its mark, and they're just buying anything, any dip, any whatever dips there are, that there almost are none, but any individual story, that's okay because, hey, there's the Fed behind me and their ECB behind me and the Bank of England. People don't remember. Bank of England and Bank of Japan eased 3 weeks ago as well. I mean, they both have done new quantitative easing programs as well. So this is just, it is never before seen type of action by central banks. We saw something like that in 2008 and 2009 during crisis, but this is, there's not a, you know, Europe you can say is a crisis, but the rest of the world is just a slowdown or there's recessionary, you know, potential recessionary issues in, maybe in Japan or that sort of thing. But they're doing the type of action you see during crisis. And, you know, we had a 2.5-3% type of GDP in the United States. So is this the new mandate of central banks that not only in crisis are we going to act like this, but if there's even a slowdown, a hint of a slowdown, we're going to do never before type of CBDC.
Yeah, what's interesting about it is, though, that in the end, we have to really respect one point. And I think that it's, you know, you may call me ridiculous and you may say that, what are you talking about? And that's not the case. And, you know, everybody out there may be thinking, oh, come on, what are you doing? Who the hell is going to pay for all this?
Well, who needs to pay? I mean, you can just literally print more money. At least here. Like, in the, you know, obviously UCB has different kind of constraints. Bank of Japan, kind of have to look at the ECB slightly different than, you know, Bank of Japan, Bank of England.
So why even work? Why play this game? Why play let me ask something. Why do we even play this game? Why not just give people money and just be done with it? In other words, just let it go and just give people their money. And why this whole hassle, this whole joke of putting it in the markets?
It's the optics of it all. I mean, let's go back to 2008, 2009. Instead of going, you know, Paulson waving, one sheet of paper or three sheets of paper and saying...
Three. That was unbelievable.
I demand $800 billion or the world ends in 3 days, which maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Who knows in retrospect. But and I need to give it to the banks. Or actually, you know, his original reason or request for that money was, I forgot exactly even now, I think they were going to buy bonds or they were going to buy debt, and it ended up being an injection after they actually got the money. They changed the terms. You know, it was kind of a bait and switch. What about if he had come and said, look, I want to give $800 billion to the American people, you know, like a rebate check. I don't know how much it would be per person, 300 million people divided by 800 billion, but, you know, I want to...
I'll take it. That sounds good to me.
But wouldn't the GOP come in and go, hey, that, we don't, you know, that's socialism. You know, so...
It's a joke.
I think... yeah, I'm not picking on the GOP. I'm very apolitical, and I think both parties are, you know, beholden to our corporate.
They both suck. Both parties suck. Move on.
Yeah. but you know, a lot of this stuff is kind of inefficient, as you're trying to get to. Is why are we doing all this stuff through the back door? Why don't we just say, hey, everybody gets a $20,000 check, and away it goes? Well, I think it's going to happen to student loans in a couple of years. I think in about 15, 20 years, you're going to see. There's a big student loan bubble bursting. Earlier this week, I actually wrote on my blog, there was a massive, massive increase in credit. And everybody was excited. Hey, the U.S. consumer is back. We haven't seen this level, I think it was like since 2001, that level of increase. And when you looked under the numbers, it wasn't credit cards actually decreased. The big explosion was federal student loans.
So why would that increase only in 1 month?
Well, it's not just one. No, that's what increased the. That's what made the surprise. Let's put it that way. It wasn't just. It's increased fourfold. Federal student loans since 2008. Think about that.
Yeah, that's a problem. And then they can't get out of school, and there's a difficulty getting a job. And maybe not as difficult as it was a couple of years ago, but it's very difficult to get a job.
Well, jobs worthy of that degree.
Right.
A lot of people, and I've been following this for a long time, so I'm going to, you know, this is something I'm going to be watching. It's, you know, it's just like the mortgage issue. This is going to take a lot longer to play than the mortgage issue. But over one out of four people are already defaulting on their student loans, and a lot of them now are federal-based, so it's basically another Ponzi where, you know, hey, if the federal government, if a private bank loses it, quote unquote, the bank should go under, or we're going to bail them out. I guess is the asterisk. if it's the right bank, if it's Bank of America or J.P. Morgan or Wells, but if it's the government, it just kind of that just added to the deficit. You know, we lost $80 million on federal student loans that, in theory, can't be discharged. But you know, if you can't pay, you can't squeeze blood from a stone. So my point, though, is, we have another bubble forming in student loans. A lot of people are going out there. You follow the participation rate in the labor data. Mm-hmm. This is the first month in a long time. It's actually gone up this month by 0.2%. But if we have a typical participation rate of around 66%, the unemployment rate would be about 2% higher than it currently is. And we've been wondering, where are all those people? A lot of them apparently are going back to school with federal loans that they may or may not choose to pay back in the future. So I think you're going to see a big forgiveness, just like we're trying to do now on mortgages. I think you're going to see a big forgiveness plan down the road. Maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 20 years. I don't know where. But there's just this huge load of debt that has now surpassed credit card debt across the entire country. It's not going to get paid back. It's
so
really
this leads us, Mark, this leads us right into the topic of, and I say this seriously, moral hazard. So why don't we just, for a second, you and I just say there's moral hazard. Fine. Okay, great. And let's live the moral hazard for a second, just for a moment. Because instead of being the, you know, the one to say, you know, you got to be careful of this, you got to be careful of that, you got to look out for the potential for, you know, a failure of Greece. Well, who gives a crap if Greece fails? You know what? Greece failing actually was good for the U.S. stocks. The markdown by S&P of U.S. bonds and the credit rating of here was actually amazingly good for the bonds and for the stock markets. I don't know what that was all about, because I guess people were bringing it over here saying, you know, we're bad, but it's not going to get much worse. And let's talk about playing that moral hazard in that, why should I not just take my money and invest right now?
It's hard for me to argue against that. It's hard for me to argue against that. And, you know, you kind of sit there and go, these are the way things should be. And then and then you have to sit there and go, these are the way things are. And what are you going to invest in? Or, you know, which scenario? You have to invest in the way things are. So you've been following the markets a long time. Really, the godfather of moral hazard was Alan Greenspan.
Oh, yeah. He was the best.
LTCM in 97, which, for those not familiar with it, was the one of these hedge funds, really a bunch of PhDs, a bunch of, I think they had Nobel laureates on it, and they were just doing great. But they got too big, and there was a currency crisis in Asia, and it just caused all kinds of issue. And Greenspan came in and basically, you know, cut interest rates dramatically. And that's basically been the, you know, 1999 before Y2K, massive drop easing, let's put it that way, in the monetary supply, and it created basically the Nasdaq bubble. And once he turned the spigot the other way, you had March 2000. And obviously we had, maybe a cyclical recession that would have hit anyways. But, yeah, it's hard. It's when, like they say, don't fight the Fed. And now it's kind of don't fight the global banking cabal, if you want.
Yeah.
I just posted something on my website, I think it was Wednesday, that central bank balance sheets as a percent of GDP have basically doubled almost every major central bank. The ECB, in a matter of, you know, 8 weeks, has gone to over 32% of GDP, of the Eurozone GDP, from 18% in 2008. Just massive. And we're the laggard at around 19% or 20%. So when Fed, Ben's considering another QE program or sterilized QE or Operation Twist 2.0, he's probably looking at that and go, hey, we're behind the ball with everybody else. So,
but Mark, let me ask, how
do you invest in that scenario?
Yeah, you gotta invest. I mean,
you have to have two paths. You have to go, well, this is what the non-moral hazard, or people should feel pain, or this sort of thing. But that's not really the reality. They don't want anybody to really feel pain, because, you know, the central bankers have their jobs, politicians have their jobs, and, you know, they're working together to make sure there's really, really no pain out there.
But so, you talk about the GDP and the central bank levels, but I'm under the impression that the U.S., the Fed, central bank, is not a component of the government. It's not our
money. Well, I'm not saying it's a component of the government. I'm just saying their amount of easing they've put into the system as a percent of GDP is, you know, I think, like I said, 19%. And all these banks were like 8 to 12 or 15%. You know, the Fed had a balance sheet, I think, of about 800 billion. B, that's a B, before the, you know, T that we're used to, you know, pre-crisis. And now I think it's 2.9 or 3 or whatever it might be. And we're considering adding more to it. So it's very difficult, you know, like you said, moral hazard. Anytime, you know, we even have a dip now, 3%, 5%, the Wall Streeters come in and say, you know, and it just takes a rumor. It just takes a Wall Street journalist to write a story. A leak, and, you know, there's QE, 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 and I don't know if you saw the story by Fisher, who's the Dallas president. He said this is morphine. You know, this is a morphine drip that's ridiculous, you know, but he's not going to be the Fed president or the vice president anytime soon. So there are people even in the Federal Reserve that gotten to the point of ridiculous levels, but it's a board, and I know Bernanke is a lot more quote-unquote consensus gatherer than Greenspan, who would seem to be an entity into himself. But at the end of the day, it's basically what Bernanke wants to do, and
yeah. No kidding. But you know what's the funny part? Have you noticed that the non-voting board members are always the ones talking about how they shouldn't do anything? And the ones that are voting members always come up and like, yeah, we should probably do more easing, and, you know, there'll be a possibility of bond purchase and all that. Have you noticed that?
Well, I did notice that, and then this year, you know, they rotate, you know, other than the New York Fed gets to keep his spot at all times, and the vice president and the president obviously stay there, but they rotate the other members, and, you know, as of January 1st, speaking of what changed on January 1st, there were a couple hard money guys that left,
right.
And a bunch of
exactly.
came into place, so...
Right.
So even better for, you know, again, the risk on trade. So
yeah.
it's a very difficult environment. Like I said, I wrote on my blog earlier this week as well a couple of things that anybody who just started investing as of 2009, they probably have a very different framework than me and you and
yep.
people that have been doing it for 10 or 15, 20 years, because we're used to seeing different kind of markets where we talked about this a little earlier about there was more human emotion, ebb and flow. Now we have kind of a lot of computerized trading. We have backstops and everything. Markets go in one direction for much longer than they used to. If you look back, what I'm comparing this period to is basically the QE2 period, when late August, well, summer, September, October of 2010 through February, March of 2011, there was a dip, I think, somewhere along the line there of about 3 to 5%.
I don't remember. A dip?
Straight up. Pretty much straight up. Yeah. There was one.
That was straight up. This one's different, though. This isn't just straight up. It's more of a 45-degree angle constant.
Yeah, it's constant. There's no pullback. I mean, we had one Tuesday, and then the very next morning we had, as we discussed, the Wall Street Journal leak of sterilized quantitative easing is under consideration. I don't think it's going to happen this next meeting because it just was floated, but that's maybe 6 weeks after this meeting, which is coming next week.
How cool would it be to just sit in a room and figure out ways that we can bamboozle the public to believing that taking money from the left pocket to the right pocket is actually helpful?
Well, it is, and there was a report actually yesterday on wealth, quote unquote wealth creation. What Bernanke believes in his heart, and I don't doubt he believes that, is, you know, he seems to be of the trickle down theory that if you enrich the stock market class, and really, Andrew, I've done a lot of stuff. There's studies out there. I study this stuff really, really closely. I think 80% of assets about are in the top 10%. We're talking about 1%, 99%.
Mm-hmm.
In the top 10%, and it's more concentrated even in the 1% and the 0.01% and the 0.1%. But, you know, everybody talks about half of Americans have their money in the stock market. You know, true. But Joe, you know, Schmo Sixpack, who has $380 in his Roth IRA, or he's his 401k at work for $2,000, that the minute he leaves that job, he's going to cash out because he's not really educated about, you know, the whole idea behind it. But, yeah. So if you look at it that way, 50% of Americans do have something in the stock market, but the vast majority is in the top 1 and the top 10%. So the Fed does a survey every quarter of, you know, the wealth and, you know, wealth created or wealth lost, and there was a big uptick because of the rally late last year. October was one of the best months in a long time. So there was a rally, but who's that accruing to? It's accruing to the top end of our population, who already is in good shape. They, you know, college-educated people have a 4% unemployment rate. And when inflation picks up, because, you know, these things are inflation, everything is hurting the dollar. When the dollar goes down, which you can disagree or agree, there's good parts of the dollar going down because it helps our exports, but there's negatives. You know, it makes imports more expensive, increases the cost of living for everybody. So right pocket, left pocket, if we're going to do policies that hurt the majority, but help the top 10%, is that something we should do? I mean, that's kind of what we're doing. Savers, if you're a saver, if you're a conservative, saver.
I know. I had a conversation with somebody today, and they were talking to me about their father, and said that, you know, what do I do now? I mean, he's got a chunk of money, but he doesn't really want to take any risk, but he's not making any, he just can't make any money on it, and what do I have to do? I said, you know what? The choices are very few right now, and if he doesn't want to take risk, you really have no choice.
You really don't. And Bernanke was asked about that his last quarterly conference. He was asked about it. His answer, he was basically evasive. It was like, you know, it was a point-blank question of, you know, your policies are basically screwing savers. What do you have to say about that? It wasn't worded that way. I think Steve Leisman from CNBC asked
it. Yeah, he did. Yeah, I remember that.
And he basically said, well, savers would like a better economy overall, which is true. I mean, there's no counterfactual to that. There's nobody out there that wants a bad economy other than maybe someone wants to be president. Maybe Mitt Romney for the next, you know, 6 months.
Right.
But that's true, Ben. But, you know, that's basically what his answer is. Like, we need to get the economy better. And so he really didn't answer the question. So basically, you know, if you're a saver, it's very, very difficult. There's, you know, money markets are 0.2. CDs are, if you're lucky, 1, 1.5, whatever it might be. But that's really not, I mean, that's not keeping up with, you're going negative in real rates. You know,
yeah.
Inflation, even the government inflation, which is what, 2, 2.5%, 1.5, that range. Which many have claimed is understated, including, you know, PIMCO's Bill Gross. is understated. Your money in a CD is losing money. You know, yeah. Real. So there's no answer. Like you said, there's no place for that money to go. Your Bernanke wants you to risk assets is what you have to say. And the question is, do I want to lose 1% a year real return after inflation to keep my money in a CD or more than that in a money market? You know, but you want to be a little bit more liquid, or do you have to follow where Bernanke is pushing you? So it's very difficult. And you know, like I said, it is left pocket to right pocket in many ways. If you're a stock speculator or you have a lot of assets in the market, you cheer every time he does these type of things. If you're conservative or you don't have any assets in the market, or you have a couple thousand and you have to go and buy groceries and gas and, you know, those type of things, and literally anything priced in dollars, you're punished.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it is a big problem. And I mean, you know, the theme, I guess, for moving forward right now is going to be, first of all, I think you have to be aware, and I can tell you a couple of real quick, I won't bore you with it, but war stories that of stocks that, you know, they hit a point of a level that really they should collapse, fade, you know, move down, break down. And it should be a reasonable person's level of, that's the stop I'm going to take, because beyond this, it's just not going to work.
Right.
You know, and honestly, a day later, out of absolutely nowhere,
Vice turns around. Right?
Not only turns around, not only it's obnoxious they turn around so hard.
Well, I've been living that. I can't even talk about what I'm doing currently, but I can talk about what I did up to the 29th of February. And I write monthly letters to my investor base because I like to keep them in touch with what's going on. And you know, the farther we've gone straight up in this market, you know, typically you have an advance of 6-7 weeks, and you pull back for maybe 2 weeks. Even in healthy markets, that's typically how it works before you start the next leg up. And we haven't had any pullback, so you want to participate in the market going up. So I'm sure you're doing the same thing. You use either stops or mental stops or real stops. And what's been happening is a lot of times, you know, the farther the market goes up, you make your stops a little bit tighter, but you're like, when this pullback comes, if I'm in high beta stocks and the market pulls back 5%, my stocks are going to fall back 10-15% just because that's the nature of what they do. So let me put my stop here at 3% or 2% or 4% where this moving average might be. And like I said, when those things, they go down, they hit the moving average, they break support, and you're like, well, I'm smart. 2 days later, right back where you sold it, or you know, where you ended up buying in the first place, so you're sitting there with your 4% loss, and your stock's running without you. So that's been happening a lot. It's kind of, like I said, it's kind of a strange behavior.
Well, it could be. It's like conditioning.
Yeah.
I mean, conditioning, because I could tell you, I've had three circumstances that I said this is will hold it even longer than we think, maybe on the downside. And there's not a big number, but you know, and then you finally say, you know what, this isn't going anywhere. The market's been doing some, you know, on a reasonable day and. Or a week or a month, and you know, this is a good stock, but you know what, there's better options I think right now, because this chart looks like it's broken and dead, and you know what, there's just no saving this right now, a lot of downside pressure. And honestly, seriously, within 2 days, very quickly right after that, it's not because I did it, because but you have to be, and I went even lower than the point that I thought.
Right. You don't think they're waiting for Andrew Horowitz to sell before they pull it up? Come on, you know that.
They're watching. They've got cameras here. They do. They have cameras here. No, but it's unbelievable. I mean, and with no news, by the way.
Well, riddle me this. I'm not seeing so much the stagnation and then I sell out and then the stock goes up. I'm seeing kind of like a break of support and then it just reverses right back up. But riddle me this. If you are a computer programmer from MIT and you're working in a hedge fund, don't you build a model that does exactly against, you know, what we're doing, you know, that has been traditionally the way to do it? Don't you say, well, look, right when that support breaks, and even let's say it goes 1% below a support level that everybody's looking at, and you know that's going to trigger stops and reasonable people to get out and say, well, traditionally when a stock breaks down here, you're going to start seeing downside. That's a good place to short. Don't I build a computer program that says I want to buy there?
Yeah, no, I agree. Not only do I want to buy there, it's more than just want to buy. And this is, by the way, I like how you use the word trigger. Thank you so much. That's the whole point of the trigger points that we've been using, and it's been very successful actually on this exact point. Because, you know, what are those levels beyond what is traditionally used, whether the moving averages, whether just, you know, simple support resistance lines that you're going to kind of draw across, you know, on highs and lows and things of that nature, or is, you know, some kind of a turn of an indicator. But what's really interesting is what we have found is that if you can find those levels, exactly what is happening is what you describe, is that it's not only looking to pick up something maybe on the break and all that, but what it's looking to do is to almost create fear and panic and then ramp it the opposite direction, because there's something else that happens in that circumstance. And that when you see a confirmed breakdown, people may be selling, but you know what else happens? Traditionally, people would be shorting.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So you're going to squeeze the end.
You're going to do an immediate squeeze. Right.
It's on high volume, which traditionally, again, if you're a traditional technical analysis, a breakdown of support on high volume is just, it's not a yellow light, it's a red light. It's like, get out and short it if you're running a long short fund or if you're a long short retail investor. So yeah, that's the double whammy. Not only are, say, a long only investor getting stopped out, and then you get the opportunity, you take the small loss, relatively small loss, and then you have the opportunity cost you've missed. Then you get the double whammy where I'm going to come in and short that, and then you get the second loss. So you're taking a loss both ways if you're actually following a lot of things that worked, say, from 90, and I started the market in 96. And I didn't
really start, 1960.
Yeah. Well, no. I'm just saying, yeah, this stuff worked in the 90s, worked in the 80s, and it worked in up to a point in the zeros, you know, say mid-decade, you know, 2006, say. But now, I just think, I think a lot of it's just because of the computerization of it all, and I think, you know, my theory, which you're agreeing with, is that there are now models that look for those traditional, where they know there's a ton of people out there following traditional signposts or triggers, as you want to use, and when that triggers those people to do a traditional behavior, they're coming in and just taking the opposite side of that trade, and they're milking it really well. Now, eventually, traditional selling is going to actually work, but you are going to be conditioned that you're not going to be in there to take advantage of it, and I'm not going to be in there to take advantage of it, because you've touched the stove so many times. That's why I've been writing that on my website, too, a couple times the past month. You touch that stove. You keep getting stopped out. You keep getting stopped. You keep doing a short that goes the wrong way. And you're like, eventually, you're just like, come on. I don't want to do it anymore, because it's not going to work. And then by the time so many people do that, that's when it's going to start working, as you know. Right?
Like I said, it's conditioning. It's very Pavlovian. You know, you buy it. You know, whatever this, if the futures are down, you know, before the open, you know, they got to plug them and see what happens. And it's very simple logic, actually. You know, the computers will come in and they'll plug it. And if it fails, if it holds, or if it consolidates at that point, if it holds or consolidates in any direction, they'll go the other direction and see if they can move it. And if not, what will happen is if it fails, they'll just move out of it and go the other direction until it fails there. But the point is, it's not just a matter of talking about this. I think the important thing is for investors, that people are listening out there, that you need to be very careful of, is that if you're having, you know, this whole problem with your investing and that, you know, the stop outs and that, it's not such a big deal. It's kind of like last year. If you didn't do anything last year, you were fine. If you had any kind of thesis behind your investing last year, you got murdered.
Right.
You know, but it's the same thing here, is that you need to be careful, because, you know, directionally, the switch, and I'm not talking about machines so much, I'm talking about the big mentality out there. The switch will be on for a while, I mean, for a very long time, more than we think it should be, possibly, and it's going to be off for a while. And that may or may not happen right now, but when they do turn that and the selling starts, it can be brutal, and that's where that training, that Pavlovian responsive to buy, is really going to get hurt.
It will be, but of course, until that point, you feel frustrated following your rules, because you have to have a rule, you have to have a framework, you have to follow your rules. If you're, you know, like I'm one where I take small losses. I don't like taking a very large loss, so that's why I have my stops, mental or otherwise. And you know, you might be trading a lot of small losses, but when the market actually does turn to the downside, the point of that strategy, obviously, or the point of that framework, mental framework, is you're not going to take that 28% loss. You're not going to take that 35% loss, because a lot of, like, you know, like Apple right now, if it's on the current pace it's going to be able to own Greece. It's going to be able to buy Greece in about a year. You know, it's going to be that size.
That's what I heard. They're setting up their headquarters there on all the everything. You know what I mean? It's going to be called Apple Land.
They have enough cash, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, $100 million. Instead of doing a special dividend, we're buying Greece. You know, or we're buying a couple of islands in Greece.
How great is that?
Yeah, that's, you know,
for sale, Santorini, Mykonos, bargain.
Well, yeah, it's an amazing thing. So, I agree with you. Well, what do you see as a catalyst? Do you think it's just going to be exhaustion to the upside, or is it going to be something we don't know about, or is it just going to be or do you think, like, central banks at some point are actually going to quit and say, well, look, we might even, everybody prepare, we might tighten some point?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it had to be earnings, but earnings revenues are okay. Some companies are good. Some of the moves, these outsized moves that some of these stocks have made, it ridiculous. There's a very big potential, I think, to be the oil prices. I mean, they're absurd. Don't forget, oil prices at 106, and you have gas at $4. The last time this thing really hit the fan was when gas was at $4, but oil was at like $150.
Right. Well, so, we're going to have the highest, you know, this is the highest February prices we've had and the highest March prices we ever had. So you're going to see $425, $450 type of gas no matter what, Memorial Day. And, you know, just because the refiners are going to switch over. And we always have higher prices in the spring driving season, summer driving season. So we're going to see higher prices. And I think people are more prepared to pay $350, $375, maybe $4. But, yeah, $450, there's a psychological level of $4. And what you know, a lot of people are not talking about is miles driven have dropped dramatically, even year over year. Maybe that's because a lot of people less are working. But MasterCard does this on a weekly basis.
That's GoToMeeting, buddy. That's GoToMeeting.
It's down 7%. Exactly. It's video conferencing. But miles driven are down 7-8% year over year.
Right.
So people are cutting back. But it's not yet to a point where, you know, because once you get, just like with Greece or anything, when you first hear about Greece, when you first hear about all these, they're like a shock to the system. You know, but after you've heard it over and over and over, you know, you slowly, you know, humans are going to eventually conditionally adapt to anything. So, yeah, people's behavior have changed. People have had a big benefit this year because of the warm winter. And so not paying as much for, you know, people who are using natural gas or heating oil in the north. You know, people in Arizona don't know what we're talking about, but or you in Florida, maybe. I don't understand. But, you know, people are paying less for those type of things. So you're getting a good effect there. And the economy, to some degree, you know, with employment, it's improving to a degree. But, yeah, that could be a big trigger. You know, that's an obvious trigger.
I don't see any particular issues right now. I mean, war aside and all that. I don't think, honestly, I know this sounds kind of...
nothing could turn the market downward? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's nothing that I could see on the horizon right now. You know, Remember something. When the Japanese tsunami came and it created this horrible situation there, which they've continued to cover up, which we know, it was denied as any effect on the economy. And yet when we found out that there was a massive effect on the economy...
It may have been transitory,
and it may be transitory. That may be true, but to say that there was going to be no effect on the economy, that they would have nothing, and they said that the gas prices will have no effect on the economy. And if you keep on telling me that everything has no effect on the economy, then what are we even talking about?
Well, here's the thing with it. We're talking about the moral hazard at all. You know, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, 7 years ago, I knew when, you know, an economic report was good or bad, kind of. Not that what the market was going to do that day, but I knew what that meant for the market to a degree over the coming weeks and months. Now, I write this all the time. I put the economic data point out there, and I say, I don't know if it's good or bad because, like, there's a Goldilocks point that it is good. There's a too strong point that might be too strong because that means less central bank easing. And then there's a bad point, which is not really bad because the worse things get, what does that mean? It's the David Tepper.
I was just going to say that. It's the Tepper. That was perfect. It's very simple. Right now, the conditioning is that if things don't go well, the Fed will step in. So if things go really well, we don't think of that side. Just is going to go well because we don't think that, you know. And I think that is the mentality.
Things can never get so well that the Fed would actually tighten. That's impossible.
Right. It would always going to be just, as you said, Goldilocks. And we have a condition right now that I think stocks are in that zone. And companies, by the way, companies, the longer these interest rates stay down, the better they are off in terms of being able to refinance their debt at ridiculously low costs.
Well, they pretty much all done. Anybody that has or could has done it by now.
Yeah, I mean, there's still some out there, but I agree. I totally agree with you. And so they are just lean, mean fighting machines. The technology is doing well for them. They are, you know, a lot of companies have been seeing some layoffs. I mean, even though the small companies are actually picking up. In hiring, but
big corporations are, you know, and when we talk about corporations, you got to be careful. You can't throw them all. We're talking public companies that are on the stock market.
Yeah.
They are doing very, very fine. They'd be able to drive down labor costs dramatically because they use the recession to cut labor costs, and there's no real wage pressure because there's so much lax supply of human capital in this country. They can arbitrage, you know, the multinationals. They can arbitrage across countries, their taxes, their labor.
Yep.
Everything. So they're in a very, very nice sweet spot. Now, with all that said, there was a huge upswing in profitability in 2009 and 2010. You know, 2009 was just a rebound from, you know, crazy low, you know, the Lehman, the AIG era, the Fannie, Freddie. So they had that big uptick. And then 2010, they really didn't need to hire anybody, and demand came back from Asia. China did a massive, speaking of, you know, central banks and central command, China did a massive injection of money of all types. early 2009. So that drove revenue for, you know, for Asia. You know, India was still fine, that sort of thing. Australia benefited. So that was 2010. Now 2011, things have started to slow down a little bit in corporate profitability. But you've had a record profitability. You've had tons of tax breaks given because the ideology is tax rates are too high in this country. You know, they throw on the 35%, which is something that I'm probably going to pay. You might be paying. Small business guys are paying out there, but guys that have locations across the globe in 40 different countries, they're paying 15% or 17%. And the effective tax rate last quarter, I think, was 12.7% for U.S. corporations. So all this 35% stuff, and over the last 20 years, it's been between 19 and 22. That's the reality. So when they say 35, it's
yeah,
not.
Yeah, no, I know. But we're gonna have to. That's the other thing. It's gonna be the. I'll tell you what it's gonna be. If you want to know my opinion, I think it's gonna be this. It's gonna be a 1-2 punch. That is potentially gonna be problematic, and it may not be permanent, and it may just be whatever. But if you're asking me, it's gonna be the expiration of tax. A lot of the tax cuts and Bush tax deals.
You think that's gonna happen though?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to happen. I really can't see that
it's
happening.
It's after the election, my friend.
No, I'm saying you think January 1st, 2013, they're going to really come back on those?
I don't know. If they don't, first of all, they're going to be downgraded. The country will. I don't think that they may do that and put some stimulus in on the other side. But I got to tell you something. I don't know about you, but I have like stimulus-itis already. I mean, I'm just so sick of the word. You know, I did some comparisons. I did some surveys of how many times the word like
Google stimulus?
No, I did it in Bloomberg, the Bloomberg stories. But yeah. Stimulus or and I compared it to the stock market. There's a really kind of spooky correlation.
Yeah, so. I just don't believe. Like, let's look at the payroll tax. What you're going to see, like the when the payroll tax was cut 2% originally, I believe it was late 2010. That was I forgot who the original idea was. I think it was Obama's actually. Might have been GOP's, I don't remember exactly. But I wrote at the time, ironically, that a year from now, this will not, because it was supposed to be a one-year extension or a one-year program, 2% payroll from 6.2 to 4.2.
Right.
I said a year from now, I wrote on my blog at the time, Fund My Mutual Fund, there's no way they're reversing this, because I just thought the economy would be, pretty, I call it the meh economy, M-E-H, in quotes, meh. It's not great, it's not terrible, it's not great, just kind of eh. But, this is with a 10%, people don't even talk about this. We've had 3-4 years in a row now of 10% annual deficits.
Go into a store and mark down the shirt, okay? And go see what happens when you put it back on. Nobody's going to buy it when it's not on sale anymore. Right? Are they going to wait for the sale? You cannot reverse these kind of things very easily.
Well, that happened in the auto industry, and that's why the auto industry got killed. It's a different topic I'm talking about. But they did rebates for so many years in a row, and people were conditioned to those rebates.
Right.
But my point with the... the payroll tax going away, I'm kind of not believing your thesis that we're going to see a bunch of, this big fiscal cliff. That's kind of that is one worry. It might cause the market to go down, actually, in, say, summer or late next fall when people do think. Because what's going to happen is the politicians are going to be sparring in public. They're going to talk about, we have to cut. But all these politicians want to constantly get reelected. And even the conservative, quote unquote, I use that in quotes, air quotes, they end up bending to the will of giving away. So we saw that this last year. I thought, going back to my story, I thought at my website, I said, a year from now, the Republicans are going to come out and say, we can't raise taxes in a bad economy. So I thought when that 4.2% payroll tax was cut, that no way a year from now was going to be raised because of the GOP. You know who used that line? It was actually Obama who ended up using
it. I know.
The GOP used it. So he kind of cornered the GOP in a great political, these guys want to raise taxes on you economy.
They checkmated themselves into a corner. You know what I'm saying? I hear you.
So what's going to happen a year from now? You believe that
I'm just saying, you asked me what could bring it down. I'm just telling you that it's a 1-2 punch. One, energy prices go off.
I don't see any politician saying that's, once you do a giveaway in this country, it's hard to take it back.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. But you asked me for something, and I'm telling you what could happen. I'm
not saying what. You're giving me a theory.
Because otherwise, honestly, at this point, I'm conditioned to say I don't care either. The fact is that, what will happen will happen, and I will deal with it then.
Yeah, even this, they're supposed to be cutting, I think, $1.2 billion because they couldn't come to an agreement. Billion. $1.2 trillion or whatever it might be, including, defense supposed to take a $600 billion hit. I don't think that's going to happen either. They're supposed to,
if they don't do that, that's going to be very, very sad.
It happened. I just don't see, because you know what they're going to do? They're going to say, like, we stopped the war, therefore we saved $200 billion. You know, that's how they're doing. A lot of these things are accounting maneuvers.
Yeah.
When you really look at what they've cut, it's, you know, things that are spread over 10 years, and we're going to pay for it. You know, when they try to balance these things, like, we're going to pay for it over 10 years, but we're going to give you the cut today. So we're going to give you, you know, a stimulus check. We're going to give you $200 billion, and we're going to pay for it by an increase in this over 10 years. Then when the next Congress comes in, 2 years down the road, they're going to say, "Well, we didn't agree to that." So,
well, that's our what I call our wimpy. You know, remember wimpy? That's my wimpy economy.
Yeah,
I'll give you a hamburger today, Tuesday. Anyway, listen, we got to wrap it up. Mark Hannahy is, of course, writes on the Market Montage. A great writer, does a lot of great work there, and also the manager of Paladin Long Short Mutual Fund, symbol PALFX. And like I say, congratulations on, you know, finally getting to this unbelievably high ground of
Thank
a mutual
you.
Fund manager. I'm sure that you walk around and people are constantly saying, you know, that's him. That's Hannah. Look at that guy. That's him. But anyway, seriously, yeah. No, great job, great stuff. And we'll definitely direct people over to your site to check it out. And I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, that was kind of interesting. As usual, well, we went for a long time, that discussion, didn't we? A little bit over. But I think it was worthwhile. We got some good information there, and we'll make sure to have him on again. Mark Hannah, great discussion, and really, you know, come up a long way. I remember him back when he was writing his blog and just starting out, kind of, and really impressive information that he has to offer. I'll mention in closing, you need to go over to Trigger Point Research. We'll put the links on the Disciplined Investor website and on this particular blog submission for the show notes of this episode. And you can get 14 days free over there. And again, that's not going to last forever. So if you want to check it out, that's fine. Or just, you know, simply just put your name on the list and we'll mail you some things in the future. But this is kind of exciting. And I think you'll really enjoy it. We have the Trigger Point breaking up, which if you're just looking for long positions, you can find those. We're just looking for only breaking out situations based on this whole algorithm. And you can find out more about that over at the website. And it's also breaking down and bounce. And then there's a pro package, which you get all of those. Actually, the bounce, which is either bouncing from a point where it's moving up and it's hitting a ceiling and kind of a short position, or it's kind of moving lower, consolidating, moving up. Again, these are not your basic run-of-the-mill indicators of just simple support and resistance. So again, read about this, what it is. But to put it in the layman's parlance, to kind of really talk about it so we can visualize this, it kind of support and resistance points or breakout points. And the bounce one is only available in the pro package, which kind of combines everything. But you could check that out. That's the one you get the 14-day free trial of over at Trigger Points Research. And of course, if you're looking for someone to manage your money, if you're not just looking for a simple way to trade, well, that's what we do over here. We have the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, as well as our global allocation strategies. Go over to the website, watch the 12-minute quick video, little tutorial run through. And you will find out more about that, and we can get you set up, ready to go. Until next week, I thank you for joining me. We have Brian Shannon up with us, and he's going to talk about technical analysis. He's one of the best in there. He wrote a great book on it, and probably one of the greatest graphics I've ever seen in a book, actually. We're going to have him next week, and I want to thank you. Have a profitable week. We'll see you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.